Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight.
God, you sound sexy.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
One, two, and go. Pull back the cover. Shade. Good God, it's a raid. Cut out the lights and call the law. Standing over there, the devil's son-in-law. Yeah. You don't have to do no soloing, brother. Just keep what you got. Don't turn it loose, cause it's a mother. When I count to four, I want everybody to lay out and let the drummer go. And when I count to four, I want you to come back in. I got the holler. I said it's in my feet. Feels so sweet. It's in my shape. Good God. About to wipe me to death. It's in my shape. They're about to wipe me to death. It's in my shape. I walk the floor. I wanna walk the floor. One, two, three, four, get it. Ain't it funky? Ain't it funky? Ain't it funky?
James Brown, Funky Drummer, Part 1 and 2, releases a two-part 45 RPM vinyl single in March 1970 on King Records. Part 1 was the A-side, Part 2 was the B-side, and went to number 20 in the R&B charts and number 51 on the pop charts. It wasn't released on an album until the 1986 compilation In the Jungle Groove, baby.
Clyde.
Stubblefield.
That's all I've got to say about that. That's a jam. That's all it is. It's a jam. It's a funky jam. But it's a jam nevertheless, and it's been recorded. And Clyde Stubblefield on that, in that little break, it's the most sampled bit of drumming that has ever been recorded. He was a master of the groove. And when you listen to the whole track, is it completely in time? No.
No.
Is it all over the place a little bit? The whole thing? Yes. Is the bass glued to the kick drum? No. But it's funky. And it's groovy. It's not just funky and groovy. It is the epitome of groove. Because that, and it's beautiful. It's just beautiful. And, you know, you need to talk to us about Clyde Stubblefield that we have in our garden.
We have Clyde in our garden. He happens to take the form of a pink plastic flamingo.
But he's in.
They called him Clyde.
That's right. But he's in this huge plant pot that has got a yucca in that
the
is called.
The yucca's huge.
Yeah, and the yucca is Jeff.
Jeff. No. Right. Jeff
Emmerich.
Has been with us a long time.
So Jeff Emmerich is the.
Jeff Emmerich. Fantastic engineer.
So the Beatles, etc. I mean, he was another master of recording, you know, the whole thing. And he's sadly died, as has Clive, of course. But they're both in the same pot, which makes us laugh
an awful lot.
Because you've got the pink flamingo, and then we've got the huge yoga, which is Jeff. But anyway.
And Jeff started spurting out loads of little babies now, because he's stood in a pot, a massive pot, but it's right next to a giant mofo of a yucca plant.
Yeah.
And I think they talk to each other. And I think he realised that he could actually grow a few spurts, because we bought him in Valencia like 8 years ago, and he's travelled with us all over.
Yes.
It's getting taller and taller. Well, we're going to have to stick him on the top of an Arctic next time we move. We won't get him in.
We won't get him in. Anyway, that's it. But let's get back
James Brown. Baby.
The hardest working man in show business. The godfather of soul. Mr. Dynamite. Mr. Dynamite.
Yeah.
Soul brother number one. Born in Barnwell, South Carolina in 1933. Started playing guitar when he heard Howling Wolf, which is amazing.
Yeah, I know.
Had a band called the Famous Flames, and in 1955 they contacted Little Richard when performing in Macon, who convinced him to get in contact with his manager, Clint.
We've got a cactus called Clint.
We have.
After Clint Eastwood, because it's a cactus. What else can you call a cactus?
You're very true. Anyway.
Yeah, it's a singular one, not a plural. Yeah, carry on.
Right, Clint agreed to manage them and sent them to the local radio station to record a demo session. They performed their own composition, Please, Please, Please. Inspired by Little Richard, he wrote the words of the title on a napkin, and Brown was determined to make a song out of it. So there you are. But I think the thing is about James Brown, he's actually a bit of a... I mean, he was a real maverick, and he just did what he did. And he, you know, and the music that came out of his band, because it wasn't just him, it was his band. He had a huge talent for getting brilliant musicians who understood what he wanted, or perhaps he told them what he wanted. I'm not sure, but whatever, they delivered. And the funny thing is that when we moved here, we met a guy who's one of the biggest stars in Portugal, a guy called Pedro Abrunhosa. And his first album was recorded with the rhythm section from James Brown's band, one of the later bands. I don't think Stubblefield was in it. But, you know, it just goes to... And it's like sort of this, a tenuous connection with us, really. But it's quite a beautiful thing. Because these musicians together created something that was completely fresh. It was, you know, and I'm saying that's a jam, but it's you know, you try and not tap your feet to it. You try and get on a dance, you know, even cram yourself onto a dance floor when that comes on, because they're going to be, you know, it's going to be packed.
There is something that, and sometimes words just aren't capable of expressing it. You just got to move. It's like when we were playing that song, then you're like grinning at me and grooving in the chair. It's like, and it's so funny, but you just can't help but kind of dance to it. I mean, I didn't even realise before that it's been sampled, like Clyde Stubblefield's, the samples, and been used by Public Enemy, LL Cool J, Run DMC, Ed Sheeran, of all people, and George Michael. So, I mean, it really is a language of groove, of the funk.
But it's that break. And, you know, and it's the ghost notes on his snare. It's the way he does, it's just everything. Because obviously he's a jazz drummer, because like at the beginning he's using a ride cymbal. And it's like, but it's just so quite a bizarre groove.
Yeah.
But it just works beautifully, you know.
Fantastic. Oh, and by the way, there was a guy called Fred Wesley on trombone, but not the Fred Wesley that we know about. Oh, no, it's Weasley.
Weezo. Well, they are. So, but I think a suitable mention needs to be made here for Charles Sherrill, the bass guitar player, because, of course, the rhythm section is only all about the bass and the drums, and he's all over the place there. He's really, really funking
brilliant
down
job.
And grooving down. But it's almost like they're not working... they're not like working where one's playing the same thing as the other. They're not actually working as a glued thing.
Yeah.
They're more working as onions and garlic when you're making a dish. Yeah. You know, they're different, and when they're together, they create something beautiful. But they're independent things, and I think this is what it's like. It's not like a rock and roll band, you know, like. You know, John Entwistle or John Paul Jones, where he's the sort of nail into a groove. You know, this is a different thing.
Everybody needs some James Brown.
It's raining today, and I'm just about to forget the train window girl. wonderful day we met. She smiles through the smoke from my cigarette. It's raining today, but once there was summer and you, and dark little rooms, and sleeping late afternoons. Those moments descend on my window pane. I've hung around too long listening to the old landlady's hard luck stories. You out of me, me out of you, we go like lovers to replace the empty space. Repeat our dreams to someone new. It's raining today, and I watch the cellophane streets. No hang-ups for me. Cause hang-ups need company. The street corner girls, a cold trembling leaf. It's raining today. It's raining today.
It's raining today, from his third solo album, Scott 3, surprisingly enough. Released in March 1969 on the Phillips and Fontana record labels. All I've got to say about that track, well, first it's magnificent, his voice is outstanding, the reverb on his vocal is sensational, the production is fantastic! But what's that shit in the background? In the left, it's going... You know what it is? It's ambience. It's the beginning of ambient music. And he threw it in. Or somebody threw it in.
Wally Stott.
Wallow.
I think so. I think.
Well, whoever it was, because...
He did the arrangements.
Yeah.
And for the strings.
Did he he did the arrangements, yeah. And... what it does, it gives attention to the track, which is a beautiful melody, but it's that lovely, lush voice, but it gives tension, which really shouldn't be there. If it was Matt Monro, you'd never get that. If it was Tom Jones, you'd never get that. If it was one of the crooners from the 60s, you would never get that. And what's gone on there is that Scott Walker, in his brilliance... or with his team, has created something that's got tension. And so many other artists have gone on from where he left off there. Because he went absolutely so abstract, you know, with his later records, Scott Walker. And, you know, we've listened to them. They're difficult records to listen to, but over the next few weeks, I think we're going to play some tracks from his later albums, which are tricky. But, you know, there's something going on with that record that really gets us by the short and curlies.
Well, indeed.
You didn't expect me to
say
that,
did you? No, I didn't. I just looked at you and went, really?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, his producer was John Franz. They were really good friends, actually. And John was head of A&R at Philips. And he was used to produce Dusty Springfield, Shirley Bassey, Frankie Vaughan, Harry Secombe. Oh, yes. Because remember Harry Secombe? He was in the movies. He used to present songs of praise, and he had a great voice. Great voice, didn't he?
Was he in The Goons as well? He was in The Goons, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's a comedian as well. So talented, that man. And also, Peters and Lee. Do you remember Peters and Lee?
I do. What was the song? I can't remember now.
Welcome home.
Yeah.
Welcome. Come on in.
And close the door.
Oh, well, sat by the piano and look gorgeous.
We love this show. We just love doing it. You know, so and you know, it's now syndicated all over the world. And all we do, we sit here enjoying ourselves in Samora Correa and actually just talk. And,
it's a date night. It's
just
lovely.
Great. Anyway, it's a date night, yeah.
But the one thing about the Scott Walker thing, you know, I've just been, every time we do and we play another song from him, I go for another layer of the onion. And he described himself, right, as a natural enemy of the Californian surfer. He loved Swedish art house cinema and classical music, and he was never one to follow the crowd. So when he became disillusioned with fame and he did this solo album, so this is Scott 3, I think he would produce, like, release 4 in 3 years or something.
Yeah.
But at the time, he stopped listening to classical music and he started listening to Beethoven because he was, did I say classical then? He stopped listening to pop, he was listening to classical.
Yeah.
So he was listening to Beethoven because he was the greatest expert in his medium who ever lived. Mm-hmm. Shostakovich, because he was the last of the great symphonists, and Brahms, because it was wonderfully intellectual music. And he had the collaboration with his arranger, Wally Stott, and which kind of fused Walker's, they say, his poetic lyrics and dark melodies with those magnificent orchestral textures.
Mm.
So there you go. But if you look at the credits as well, in the early 70s, Stott went through a sex reassignment surgery and became Angela Morley. So Angela was previously Wally. So the same relationship.
Okay.
So that's just the name change there. And obviously a whole new identity. We've got this, where's he looking for inspiration? He had one vocal lesson and he gave up because he thought his voice was like a beast. He always struggled with it to try and find other ways of... I think with the 4 albums, I think he kind of went to town on the voice, and then I think he started going into more other sounds and textures, didn't he, really? Became a bit
because
more obscure.
I don't think he liked all that big vibrato, that big sort of baritone thing going on.
Yeah.
And the thing is, he's been so influential to many of the artists that we admire and love as a couple of starting Campbell, you know, and specifically in this case, Tom York, who's included it as one of his 8 pieces of music he would take on an imaginary desert island, the BBC radio show Desert Island Discs in 2019.
Surprise!
This very track.
Yeah.
Now, and, you know, and David Bowie, he was obviously influenced by Scott Walker, hugely, you know, because that voice, because people talk about, you know, Burrell, and it wasn't...
Jacques.
But it wasn't the same, because Jacques Burrell had a certain voice, but Scott Walker, you know, if he sang on a David Bowie record, you wouldn't know the difference, you know, except that Scott was probably a better voice, actually.
His tonality was a bit more creamy,
yeah,
I think.
He was, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I'm sure David Bowie was around and agree with those, actually. He'd say, well,
well,
okay,
Scott.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, he loves Scott.
He produced his documentary, didn't he?
Yeah.
Exec produced it.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, thank you, David, for doing that, because at least we got to sort of get a story of Scott, and Scott knew about someone that cared about him enough to actually tell his story, you know, and tell it in a beautiful way, I think.
Yeah. And we're listening to more and more Scott Walker, you know, every... you know, every other album we put on. It tends to be, because we just love that. We love the melodies, love the sensibility. We just love his voice of production. And the thing is, as the albums progress, as we said, they get that slightly bit different. It's like turning the screw. You're like,
the thing is, you've got one life and you've got one chance for every album to actually just say what it is you want to say. Do something different. We're not after likes or swipes or scrolls or doom scrolling, whatever it is, you know. We're actually, as artists, trying to say something about life right now. Music, Street Life, the opening track from their third studio album, Stranded, and it was released as the first single from the album in November 1973 on the Island record label.
Rock's music. Mm. Also, well, the pioneers of art. Rock. So Stranded is the pioneering, one of the pioneering workers of art rock. Centurion. Yeah. Now, no, let's be serious, because, you know, again, connected with Scott Walker, and I don't know why this show's come about thematically, because we don't sort of think about, you know, we just put tracks together that we're listening to, or we like, or we've just heard, or we just different stuff, don't we?
What's in the ether during that week, really?
Yeah, and you know, and this has just popped up, and it's connected, of course, to David Bowie and the art rock movement, and then Scott Walker and all that other stuff, and it is quite a bizarre thing, totally different than James Brown, of course. You know, that came from Clive Stubblefield, but this, you know,
it was quite, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a completely different thing. I mean, the For Your Pleasure, the second record, is one of my personal favourite records of all time. I think it, you know, it really epitomised what was happening with the art rock movement and the psychedelia. So the end of psychedelia, the beginning of glam rock, you know, the thing that moved through the 70s. Because what I don't think sometimes I appreciate is that, like, all the stuff in 1967 was happening with Cream and all that. It was only 9 years until punk.
Right.
So you think about that, right? So 1967, and punk started in 76. So you've got that 9 year period, and it went from all that, you know, flowers in your hair stuff, to what was happening with the Ramones and the Sex Pistols and all those people, and then the post-punk stuff, and then this arrived, you know, and it's such a short period of time.
Yeah.
So you know, I mean, if you listen, if you think about 2011 and then 2020, what has happened really in that period? So dramatic. Nothing.
No. There was one thing, you know, when I started researching this show, so the song's written by Brian Ferry, recorded at Air Studios, and produced by Chris Thomas, the guy who worked with the Beatles, Pink Floyd, who we mentioned on our special two-part show for Dark Side of the Moon and the 50th anniversary, Procol Harum. And apparently Chris, he played bass on this track because their regular bass player, John Gustafsson, couldn't get a line to work. He couldn't work it out. So he got frustrated and he just tracked the bass on it.
Is that right?
Yeah, so he came in the studio in the morning and he'd done it because it just wasn't working.
Wow.
Which I thought was quite interesting.
So like a Visconti type character.
Wow. So this went to number 9 in the UK singles charts, and the album went to number 1, which is fantastic. But it's the first album after Brian Eno had left the band, who was replaced by Eddie Jobson.
Mm.
So you've got Phil Manzanera on guitar. And they were talking about trying to get these street sounds, right? And we got Andy McKay on sax. And they attempted to record the street sounds by dangling a microphone from a window at Air Studios to try and capture the sound of the traffic. But it didn't work.
So what did they use?
They used a sound effects vinyl from a market in Morocco instead.
Well, that's amazing. Because the other thing is that I was going to mention later on is that at the beginning there's that noise.
Yeah.
And doesn't that sound very much like the noise that was in the Scott Walker track from the one before? And I've only just noticed it because when you're listening on Kansas, as we do on the show, because that's what we do. We do listen to the tracks before we talk about them. A lot of podcasts and music shows,
they just do links and drop them in between songs.
But we don't do that. What we do it organically, and we so it takes us A, longer, but B, it's a date night, so we enjoy it.
Indeed.
So we're actually listening to each other's records, you know, and talking about them, which is really, really cool. But listening to that, it's quite fascinating. The other thing I've got to talk about here is old Manzanera. Now, Phil Manzanera, the guitar player in rock music, is he the greatest guitar player in the world? No. But he has a sound, and he has and all the way through that, there's that same line, da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da, and it's all the same all the way through. And it's almost, you'd think it'd get boring, but it doesn't, because it's just sort of, it's a sound, and I don't know what it is about his playing, but all the way through Roxy Music's career, when he's been in the band, it has definitely his sound, you know. And they've always had brilliant bass players. I mean, you know, a few weeks ago we had Manifesto on, which is basically just a bass solo.
Yeah.
At the beginning, and it's a bass solo all the way through, really. And even when the vocal comes in, you know, he's still twiddling around and up there. But it's beautiful, you know.
And, I can hear it now.
Yeah, and there's a certain thing about what the rhythm section do. And Paul Thompson, great drummer, and you know, the doing stuff that is or was very, very, very different to everything else.
I think also because he came out of art college, and so he had this kind of artistic visual aspect as well to the band. So they had the whole caboodle. You've got this kind of intelligent sort of intellectual hunger for turning their art into more than just a pop song.
Yeah, and I mean Brian Eno originally, you know, because like I said he didn't last very long in the band because they thought he was a bit weird. He used to get a lot more girls apparently.
Well,
than
yeah,
Brian
apparently
Ferry, but he used to piss everybody off.
Everyone used to shout Eno. He used to really piss them off.
You know, and he was balding and very odd looking then. You
yeah,
know,
he does look a bit, but he had some really cool clothes on.
Yeah, but the other thing, and I just want to leave it, Phil Manzanera, because I forgot to mention this before about him, is that he used to play a Gibson 335, which is like the BB King looking guitar.
Okay. Ever,
that's what a 335 looks like. And as soon as he joined the band, they all said, Eno and Brian Ferry said, you need to lose that guitar immediately. He was not allowed to play it. He played it on the first studio album, but live, he had to have a white Strat or a red Firebird that he got from a rich guy somewhere in London and bought it. I think it was for about 100 quid or something. So there you are.
That's the colour of my room where I will live. Blue, blue. Pale blinds drawn all day. Nothing to read, nothing to say. Blue, blue. I will sit right down, waiting for the gift of sound and vision. Waiting for the gift of sound and vision, drifting into my solitude over my head. Don't you wonder sometimes about sound and vision?
David Bowie, Sound and Vision, a broken down or broken version of it, because this was recorded for a Sony smartphone advert, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's true.
Or remixed by?
Sanjay Prabhakar.
Ah.
Mm.
Hey, old Son.
Doesn't it remind you of that lovely piano, though? It reminds me a bit of Virginia Astley in Gardens Where We Feel Secure.
Right, of course.
It's that sort of broken sort of piano. I love that sound. It gets right into your heart. Love it.
Yeah, because, you know, even though that's a grand piano, it doesn't sound like a grand release. It's quite muted. Mm. And when you're in a room with a grand, and that's the funny thing, when you're in a room with a grand piano, they don't sound like Bruce Hornsby in the Range. Because when you listen to Bruce Hornsby in the Range, you know, when you hear that piano, it's very, very bright. It's overly bright, and pianos just don't sound like that.
No.
And like, if you listen to the last track, "Our Lips Are Sealed," that we just released a few weeks ago, that was recorded on our Steinberg, old, really old Steinway upright piano, and it's very dark. You know, it's a dark sounding keyboard, and that's what they are. And to get them bright, you've got to put a lot of top end, you've got to take everything out, and it makes it sound unnatural. People are used to that sound anyway.
Let's get
on with Sound and Vision,
sound
because
and vision.
The original version, of course, was on one of our most favorite albums of David Bowie, which is Low.
Yeah,
and it was recorded using the 3-stage process. And this 3-stage process is unusual in the fact that the melody and the vocals were put on last.
Yes.
So really, the drums, the rhythm section and everything was like a jam at the beginning, then just used to throw loads of shit on top of it, and then to put a vocal on, which is quite bizarre, and apparently used that for a lot of the rest of his career after.
Yeah, he did. Because there's
Berlin
something
trilogy.
About Carlos Alomar, George Murray and Dennis Davis. They basically arrived from America, and he basically got them just to jam and develop the ideas. They had nothing written. And I think what David wanted at this point, when I've read some interviews with him, so you're looking at his 11th studio album here, is he wanted to do something different.
Mm.
He was very depressed. And he was in a very up and down space. He wanted to do one side that would please the record label, but on the other side he wanted to do experimental. And he said to the guys, including Tony Visconti, be prepared to waste a month of your life because we don't know if we're going to release it. We're just going to go away and experiment.
That's absolutely brilliant.
Isn't that gorgeous?
Yeah. But when you got the money to be able to do that...
Yeah. He didn't. Do you know he didn't? He was really, really skint.
Is that right?
Bowie's first check for the Chateau bounced.
No.
Yeah. And he had to take 4 days off because he had a court case with Angie.
No.
Yeah, so, I mean, he really wasn't in a very good space financially either. So he was really depressed, and you think he is. But, you know, at that point in his career, he wasn't loaded at all. So well, it's difficult.
It is interesting. But, I mean, you know, Tony Visconti had come back on this record because, I mean, you know, Bowie's different producers from time to time. But I think his stuff with Visconti was brilliant. And the thing about Tony Visconti, I don't want to get too technical here, in that a few weeks ago I did a Vibes article on our blog. It's called vibes.starlight-camera.com. It's called Damn the Torpedoes. I don't think anybody understood the name of it. Basically, it's about, you know, just do what you want to do creatively and fuck everybody else, really. And the thing is, I mentioned about the Eventide Harmonizer, which is an electronic device which Visconti used extensively with David Bowie and also Daniel Lanois uses now all the time. We just happen to have one. I don't know why we've got one, of course. Ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho.
You know, not trying to recreate anything from those guys, but being serious. And he was using this to great effect to create different sounds. And, you know, what Eno, and Eno worked on this record as well, of course, Brian Eno, and what Eno does with Daniel Lanois and U2 and all the artists that they work with, like Peter Gabriel and all the people over the years, you know, Bob Dylan, Neville Brothers, Neil Young, Willie Nelson, is that the fact that they go in the morning, Eno and Lanois, and they go and create sounds. And that's what they do. They create sounds, then the artist comes in the afternoon, or the headline artist anyway, and they introduce these sounds into the recordings. And I think this is a great, it's a really cool way of doing shit, and we are doing that right now. We're using that very similar process right now in our Starlight One material.
It's a bit weird, isn't it? Because you're reading about this now, and we're doing it. Wow.
It is, yeah, and you know, I'm so excited. I've never been as excited about our music as we're doing now. It's so to us, you know, it's so fresh. I know to you it is. But we're creating from nothing. Because sometimes we'll write a song, won't we, on an acoustic guitar, and then we'll record a backing track or whatever, or record a guide, and then we just play it, and get the band in to play it. But this, we've been developing stuff in a completely different way. It's almost like David Bowie's 3-stage process. But unknowingly, we haven't actually researched it. You know, we listen to a lot of music, but we don't, unless we do these shows, we don't, really understand what's gone on in the background. And when you look at it, you think,
we're
doing that. You know, he was incredibly depressed. Well, yeah, we get incredibly depressed as well, you know, and these things are coming out of it. It's absolutely fantastic.
It's like fighting with wrestling with an octopus, isn't it? It's like, you come out of the shower and suddenly he's got you in a grip and you're rolling around on the floor, you know? I mean, it really is like that. But what I love about this conversation, so you can imagine you've got Brian Eno and David Bowie on a phone call to Tony Visconti saying, so you're going to come out to France then, are you? I'm like, what are you going to bring to the table? And he says, an Eventide harmonizer. It fucks with the fabric of time.
Gone is the night, gone is the day.
I agree.
is the day, gone is the night, gone is the day. She defines the only answer, and I never had the time. She defines the only reason for feeling. All in all, it's all we say love. She defines the only reason for feeling. Gone is the day, gone is the night, gone is the day. Gone is the day, gone is the night, gone is the day. Gone is the day, gone is the night, gone is the day. Gone is the day, gone is the night, gone is the day. She defines the only answer, and I never had the time. She defines the only reason.
Fontaine's DC. Inagrioth Jejua, from their third album, I'm trying hard there, Skinty Fear, released on the 22nd of April in 2022 on the Partisan record label.
Irish Gaelic's a nightmare, twice to say. You know, I'll do my best.
It's great, isn't it? But what music in the actual language as well. I've had to write it in the notes phonetically because I haven't got a chance otherwise. What a song, though.
It is. And
I love that song.
You know, we've been listening to them for a few years now since they came out. Because, funnily enough, I posted something. We don't use Facebook a right lot now, but a couple of years ago, I posted something. Said, what new music should we listen to?
Yeah.
And it was on the Met group, I think. There was a group, the Met. We were playing in October. We've got a UK tour, which is kicking off.
Yeah, we just announced the dates, actually, today.
And we're playing the Met this time. But yeah, I think it was in the Met group, and somebody mentioned, amongst others, you know, Fontaine's DC. And I looked them up, and we played the videos, and they thought they were pretty cool. But they've really matured, I think, as a band. Not as though the first record wasn't great, because I think it was. But, you know, this song particularly, I mean, it really moves you to tears, doesn't it?
It got into my marrow. I remember a few weeks ago, you know, we came back from Night Out, and I just put it on. And I kept playing it on and over and over and over and over again. It enchanted me, and it's been a long time since I've had to, you know, do that, where I just have to keep listening to it because there's something going on and I don't know what. But it spoke to my soul, and I needed to hear it and really absorb it, you know. It's a bit scary, actually. I haven't listened to it for a while until now because it's deep.
It does get you in a grip.
It got me in a grip, and it's all based on a true story as well.
Yeah, and the true story is...
Well, there was a lovely lady called Margaret Keane. Margaret, that was my mum's name. It's my middle name. Anyone who's called Margaret rocks, as far as I'm concerned. So she lived in Coventry, a former dinner lady, and she passed away aged 73. And the family wanted to put the Irish epitaph in our Inagrioth Jejua, which translates to in our hearts forever, engraved on the headstone. However, a court of the Church of England ruled that the Gaelic phrase could be interpreted as political or provocative if it was displayed without an English translation, which caused widespread anger and frustration throughout the Irish community. 3 years of campaigning by Margaret's daughters. In February 2021, the decision was overruled. Yeah. Get in there! And on the same day the news came, the band, the Fontaine's DC guys, they laid down their vocals for the song, and they sent the song to the Keane family, who played it for the mother at her grave. So it was all about the right to...
I mean, it's totally outrageous, and, you know, I don't think you need to get us on the subject of religion here. We're not going to talk about that.
But it is
totally outrageous. In the fact that, you know, when we see what is said on Twitter and what is said on social media and said in the newspapers by, you know, people all over the world, and then you can't even put that on the gravestone, it is just absolutely unfathomably stupid, and you know, and that's
unbelievable, really.
It is unbelievable.
And I think what's interesting with these guys, because they're like a bloke band, really. And again, here I am getting really into their music, which is lovely for me. And it's all because I started playing bass and living with you and meeting you and sharing different sort of styles. I think it's like I'm eating different food now, and I'm listening to, I've widened my audio taste buds, as it were. What interests me with these guys, though, is that they have this narrative, and especially with Skinty Fear, it was that thing, you know, almost like of homesickness, and about how they've all moved to London now. So they've left Ireland.
Is that right?
Yeah, so they're all in London. And there's that tension between, you know, when you're away from home, you miss your homeland, but you've got opportunity in London and you need to be there.
It's funny that, isn't it? You know, people move to London, you know, and it's one of those things where I've never done it. You moved to London for a bit, didn't you?
Yeah, I worked in London for a little bit, but I found it, well, inspirational and overwhelming and really not for me, but it was a great experience. I mean, your learning curve, there's no curve. It's like a rocket and it goes straight up, bang.
Yeah. I get that.
Fascinated. Too much information, actually. It was too much to take in.
Well, the thing is, London is you either get homogenised, so you listen to everybody else, or the bands musically, certainly creatively, you listen to everybody else and you start to do what they do, or you forge your own path and then try and fight your way through the noise and everything,
But I think you've also got to have really good friends who you've met through uni or art college or somewhere. Like, you've got your social circle, because I think it's very difficult to really meet the people that you should be hanging out with. I think it's really, London works if you've got a great social life. If you've got a great group of friends who are connected in,
yep,
you can have the time of your life.
Indeed. But I think the great thing about that song as well is that I love the sort of monotone thing at the beginning, you know, and you don't expect when the bass comes in, because then it actually gives some musicality to the whole, you know, piece. And this is the band's number, it's on the band's first number one album in both Ireland and the UK, and it won a Brit Award for International Group at the 2023 Brit Awards, nomination for Album of the Year at the 2022 Choice Prize Awards.
Yeah. And, well done, guys.
You know, it is incredible what they've done. But I've got to say that I think the production, the writing and the instrumentation on that, this whole album is absolutely sensational. Something everybody must listen to.
Well, that's it for this week's show, darling.
Wow.
So do check out our website. It's starlight-campbell.com. That's L-I-T-E for the Starlight. We've just announced a two-week headline UK tour in September and October. Come and see us. Share a night of music together. And we'll leave you with Portishead and their wonderful song, Glory Box.
I'm so tired of playing with this bow and arrow.
Summer.